The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
On 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show brought to you by Absa CIB, playing a meaningful role in the societies they serve. The bravery to imagine, that's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. Welcome to The Money Show on this Monday night. A bit of a soggy day for markets, unfortunately. We did start on a positive note and then ran out of energy and oomph as the day progressed. The currency pretty much where we left it on Friday. Lots to come this evening as we talk about the merits, the demerits, and the affordability of a monthly welfare payment in the form of a grant. We'll talk to the Chief Operating Officer at Checkers, new joint venture partner in the 60-60 delivery program. They've been involved since the start, but this is formalizing that arrangement. We'll also catch up with Toby Shepshak this evening. JP Luntman, the political trends analyst. I think he's got, at least so far, 2021 pretty much right in terms of his more optimistic than most view at the beginning of this year when we spoke to him. So looking forward to catching up with him on that point. And Hilton Kellner, not sure where he finds the time, but he is a voracious reader, is Hilton Kellner. And he gives away books to colleagues at this time of the year, books that inspire him, books that he wants people to be inspired by. And we'll go through quite an extensive list of books that he's recommending that are read this holiday season. That comes up at 20 past 7. And at 7:30, Owen Nkumane, former South African rugby player, presenter at SuperSport. Fabulous stories to be told there. All about money, other people's money, at 7:30 here on The Money Show.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
So for the first time ever, somebody born in South Africa is the Time Person of the Year. Time magazine every year names a person or people. At one stage, I think it was in the early 2000s, they put a piece of mirrored foil on the cover and said, the person of the year is you. And they were roundly criticized for that because it was a really naff. It was this idea of playing into social media and you are the center of the universe. It was all you. And quite pathetic, really. They've had some interesting people on the cover of the magazine. It used to be just men. Adolf Hitler made it onto the cover in 1938. That didn't end well. And they've had lots of really interesting people, some quite contentious individuals, other contentious individuals as well. Last year, it was Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. They were picked together as the person of the year because Time magazine doesn't want to offend people. But it's a tradition that goes from 1927. And now, this year, for the first time, a South African on the cover. And that person is the chief executive of Tesla and SpaceX, Elon Musk. And he's the first person to be born here to get that accolade. And the Time editor-in-chief, a guy called Edward Felsenthal, he writes that the person of the year is a marker of influence. Few individuals have more influence than Musk on life on Earth and potentially life off Earth as well. In 2021, Musk emerged not only as the world's richest person, but perhaps as the richest example of a massive shift in our society. I think it's a really inspired and interesting choice to see Elon Musk on the cover of Time magazine as their person of the year.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
Welcome to The Money Show this evening. The ShopRite is going into a joint venture with the company that operates its 60-60 grocery delivery service. RTT Group has been operating the on-demand delivery service. You'll know when you see the RTT logo. I'm not sure if you can visualize it right now, but it's a stylized box. It's a combination of black and red sides, the letters RTT next to it. You'll recognize it when you see it. It also owns Courier IT or Courier IT and other businesses. Rudy Kiet is the chief operating officer at RTT. Whose idea, Rudy, was 60-60? Did Checkers come to you or did you go to them and say, you know what, I've got an idea for you?
Yeah, good evening, Bruce, and to everyone else. I think it depends on which side of the fence you stand. You'll probably get a different answer. But Checkers really brought up the idea. 60-60 was already a concept. RTD's role was really, the research that we've done beforehand to look at on-demand fulfillment. We've gone to the US to look at those markets and what's happening. And we wanted to play in that space, you know, to add it to our portfolio of services. And just incidentally, the ShopRite guys, 6060, and us got speaking. And we devised together the process around our fulfillment part, but I can give them all the honor and glory for the 6060 concept.
But the point is, you were thinking about something similar. You were thinking of on-demand. They came up with 6060, and the match was made there. Have you been operating it under contract until now?
Yeah, we have been operating under contract. We've been part of the solution designed right from the beginning. Initially, as we set off, we thought our entry point to the on-demand services would have been the quick service restaurant market, and we would have added that to our portfolio for our current clients, and really with the intent of servicing consumers from the closest store. So RTT as a business has a wide footprint of clients out in the South African retail market, you know, mostly in apparel and fashion. Where we deliver to their stores and where we deliver for consumers through our courier network, through Courier Eat, as you've mentioned earlier. So our contract and the agreement we've got with ShopRite was devised from designing a solution to do grocery deliveries from their stores to the closest consumer market. And that's really how it was put together as a kind of combined solution.
Because, I mean, the logistics business is quite extraordinary in terms of, I don't know how the guys who pitch and either deliver the boxes know which box goes where, or when the box ends up in the truck, how it ever gets to where it's going. It looks like, you know, certainly a complicated business. But the 6060 is a fundamentally different proposition to delivering a parcel from Joburg to Cape Town, for example, or a package from Cape Town to London. Getting something from a shop shelf into a bag into somebody's home within 60 minutes of an order being placed is quite an extraordinarily different way of thinking of doing deliveries.
Yeah, that is absolutely so. I think, you know, again, credit to the ShopRite team. The design of this was always meant to be absolute convenience and speed. And part of the success of that is proper visibility. You know, so I think from RTT's perspective, we are able through the digital integration to see all the orders that are placed in time. We can plan and react accordingly, you know. And I think the one element that we've added to our bow is really to plan. So we've built planning tools and we've built scheduling tools to make sure that our drivers and our riders are available and capacitated. And that's part of the answer. It's not a gig economy environment. You know, you don't log on and log off as you please. This is very much a structured environment where capacity is at the forefront of the requirement. So capacity, digital integration, proper planning tools and visibility, I mean, those are the key elements of this. And then obviously you still have to operate it as well as you possibly can and deal with the type of hyperscale that we were asked to do, you know, over the last 24 months.
Are the people who ride the bikes, are they fully employed, or are they on a per ride basis? How do you pay them?
Yeah, so there's more than one answer to that. I mean, we normally pay them per ride, but there's a minimum threshold. So if certain amount of rides aren't achieved, then you know we top it up and make sure that it's achievable for these riders. These are all owner-operated riders. Our business model is a little bit different. We fund these riders with equipment, with bikes, with mobile devices. We supply them with uniforms. We supply them with airtime or data, really, to be able to transact as well as they possibly can. You know, so we try and make this for the rider as good a business as it possibly can be. And then, obviously, the ownership of the equipment transfers to the rider as well. So these guys are, in most cases, most of the time, they're working for us. But they have freedom, you know, as individuals out there and owner operators, you know, to also do other work where that may suit them.
How do you manage the way in which they ride? Just recently, I've noticed, and maybe it's Christmas, maybe it's because there are fewer cars on the road and the guys are more visible, but I've looked at these guys and they're under pressure to deliver. And it is leading, in my experience, to some pretty adventurous riding tactics on the road. How are you managing that?
Yeah, so, I mean, we have a number of tools. I think, firstly, Bruce, the levels of training that we go through is quite, I want to say, intense. We spend a lot of time on rider training, specifically defensive rider training, awareness for these drivers. But, you know, we calculate, our integrations are quite complex. You know, we calculate through certain integrations with TomTom, for instance, the riding times, how long it takes to a location, how long it takes back to a location. And we make it quite simple. You know, we allocate work to riders that are at the store, firstly. You know, so you don't want to put riders under pressure to return to store and rush and chase and do anything that is potentially illegal or putting their lives at risk. But we also do our deliveries mostly in a small radius. It's around 5-6 kilometers. So this is not far distances that these riders have to travel. But again, the emphasis being on road safety awareness, proper training when they start up, and making sure that these guys have good equipment.
Yeah, okay. I mean, and again, you know, it's if the guys are under so much pressure and time constraints, and it's some of the delivery times might be a bit unrealistic. I've had good experiences with 60-60. I've had one terrible experience with 60-60. They're going to start doing silly things. I mean, what are the consequences for irresponsible road behavior for people who are being told by a boss or a shift manager, get this packet there in 3 minutes and it's 7 minutes away?
Bruce, there's actually none of that. You know, so we allocate an order to a rider. He's got 30 minutes to deliver it, in fact. You know, so it's not 60 minutes. The 30 minutes is actually to allow for the store to do their picking, for the orders to be channeled and handed over to the rider. And our drive times are actually around 17 minutes. So it is much less than that. So I don't think that's much of a play in any of the areas that we are in. And I've got to give credit to the teams. I mean, we've done a lot of work on the polygons, which really is just the radius and the demarcated area that the riders ride in. We have managed that so that it's shorter distances and there's less overlap of riders having to go to certain areas. So I think we've done a good job in getting that right. And that's part of the recipe, is to make sure that works well.
So what goes into the JV then? You bring the management, you bring the riders, you bring all of that sort of stuff. What does ShopRite put into the JV?
Yeah, I think in addition to what we bring is also the technology on the delivery side of that. I think ShopRite, you know, as a partner, we all know the success story around 60-60. They bring additional e-commerce initiatives that will flow over time. You know, I think there's also other items that they could help us. You know, ShopRite's a very customer-centric business. I think we would like to do more on the customer centricity, the customer experience at a rider level. You know, and I think what it brings for both parties is a consistent ability to invest both in the technology platforms, but also in the assets and the people that we contract and that we employ. You know, so I think it's a more unified effort. It's an alignment of our plans. Certainly, RTT wants to make this network available to the rest of our client base as far as we possibly can. And I think what the ShopRite Checkers guys want to do is to make sure that what one entity where they can actually invest in, sharing the benefit of it, but also, you know, impact the client experience to the best of their abilities.
If COVID had not happened, when would 60-60 have happened, in your view?
Yeah, it happened before COVID. I think the rapid scaling of it would have taken a much longer time. I mean, you know, Bruce, we often talk about it. In March of last year, we were operating about 15 stores, and a couple of months later in June, we were operating at 60. You know, so it's gone through gigantic growth spurts. You know, and in fact, you know, from then it doubled again after that, you know, and we're at nearly 150 locations at the moment and in all 9 provinces. So, you know, I think it would have taken a long, long time. COVID has really, really pushed us forward. But we see a step change often. You know, every time we think, you know, it looks like it wants to normalize, you know, it just takes another step up. You know, and basically today, you know, looking back at the past year, we do about 3 times the volumes we did a year ago. And it is just amazing. And I think it's convenient. It's easy to use. Obviously, the products that get sold through it is attractive for the consumer. But the service has to be reliable. You know, and I think that's the part that we play. We want to make sure that service is absolutely reliable. It's in time. It's friendly. You know, it must be enjoyable. It must be very convenient.
It's the fabulous story. Thank you very much for sharing with us this evening, Rudy Kiet, the Chief Operating Officer at RTT, going into a formal joint venture just 18 months after they launched the pilot projects of operating the Checkers 60-60 delivery business, getting groceries from shop to home reliably in quick time. It's really interesting to see the evolution of global logistics and how South Africa has taken a huge step up in the last 18 months and become far more global in that approach. As a result, sort of invigorated, I suppose, by COVID-19 and the huge demand that's been put on delivery services. Pick and Pay have got their own one. Woolies have got their own one. And, of course, the category leader at the moment certainly seems to be 60-60.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
Yeah, markets were kind of quiet on the day. Started on a positive note, above 72,000, and then gradually just oozed all of the hope and optimism of the early part of the session into a gelatinous pool of gunge at the end. That's a bit too graphic, isn't it? But yeah, down about a third of a percent by the close. Arthur Karras is a portfolio manager for Macro Solutions at the Old Mutual Investment Group. And I mean, yeah, today's a bit of a damp squib of a day, Arthur. But what a year. What a year 2021 has turned out to be for not only global stock markets, but for the JSE as well, finally.
Absolutely. It started in the middle of last year, really. Once we realized that COVID wasn't going to kill us all, and then everyone started looking amongst the wreckage to find some gems. And at the same time, I think low interest rates around the world, lots of liquidity in financial markets, that all kept everyone with any kind of investment capital hungry for investment ideas, any place where they could earn a return, which they weren't going to earn in cash.
And that has played through this year very, very nicely. And for the last 8 months or so, the global worry has been on inflation. We saw Friday's inflation numbers out of the United States at 6.8%, which by American standards is a big and terrifying and hairy and ogre-y number. And that seems to be weighing increasingly on sentiment on markets.
It's coming from two ways. The one is, yes, you'd expect inflation to pick up, given the amount of stimulus that the global economy has seen, and given the fact that we've got all these little supply chain, or I should say little, all these supply chain induced issues in markets. But the larger concern, and it hangs around the meaning of a word that I believe the Fed has now stopped using, is around the word transitory. So if we're going to see some inflation, which is then going to return back to a more normal trend level, then this is nothing to worry about. Then we're going to simply see interest rates tick up a little bit, as one would expect when the economy normalizes, and that would be it. But if inflation is not transitory, if we're now starting to see the beginnings of a inflationary stage in the global economy, that would be very worrying. We haven't really seen anything like that since the 70s. That would cause investors to have to reconsider the kind of playbook that they've had in action for the last more than 25, 30 years, where we've seen a very, very consistent, at a global level, bull market in fixed income. We've just seen long-term interest rates go down steadily, and that's supported investments for a long time. That and the additional liquidity and low rates have been pumped into markets every time we've seen a crisis, going back all the way to 2000. So if that reverses, then that means we have to really think carefully about what we can expect to happen next.
Okay, so but how are you thinking about 2022? How are you thinking about the year ahead? Are you thinking, you know, maybe not quite the returns of what 25% that we are seeing possibly so far this year on the JSE, perhaps something a little more modest, if anything at all?
What we're expecting to see in 2022 is not the end of the up cycle. So there's still plenty of stimulus in the economy. There's still quite a lot of reopening trade to come with things normalizing. There's a lot of supply chain issues to shake out of the works. So, for example, 2019 has been a bad year for the automotive industry worldwide, and that's leaked into sectors like the platinum sector, which is very important to us. So if people start getting the chips out of the factories in Asia and they start going to motor vehicles and see the demand for motor vehicles pick up, and that'll normalize. Hopefully somewhere in 2022, we will see the COVID crisis dissipate somewhat on the back of vaccinations and hopefully less virulent variants. And that will allow the global airline industries, travel industries, and all of those to start to get back to normal. So there's certainly scope for economic recovery in 2022 for that to continue. What there probably isn't scope for is for valuations to increase ahead of that. So if you imagine people buying up shares in the hope of a recovery, that sends the price higher, but the earnings haven't come through yet. What we need to see in 2022 is the earnings coming through yet. So we're saying you need to be careful about having your money where the earnings are going to come up. There's no scope for earnings disappointments because in many cases valuations are simply too high. So that's really the kind of view that we're looking at stock markets in 2022.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a pragmatic and sensible view. And again, all of this, of course, is predicated on the fact that there are no nasty shocks and nobody goes and does anything stupid in the global economy. The threat of slowdowns in China and sort of intervention in the Chinese economy, those sorts of issues, those don't seem to be concerning anybody on a serious level anyway.
I think that we've always known that the Chinese have a centrally managed economy, and we have for many years seen interventions by the authorities, even in the tech sector. So we had issues going on in the gaming industry going back a number of years. The last is just a piece of that. And I think it did step up a serious level this year, where the government effectively is saying, look, we can see how powerful tech is all around the world. We're not going to allow tech companies to run China. That's not going to happen. We've got a kind of pressure on you that isn't going to happen. But I think much more importantly for China is the need to keep all of their population productively employed, keep them all working. So part of the reason why we started off a bit strongly this morning is there's a bit more belief that the Chinese are going to stimulate their economy. They've got by far the tightest monetary conditions in the larger economies. So there's room for them to ease that a little bit and help stimulate the economy a little bit, especially given the concerns that people have about the likes of an Evergrande default having an impact on their property market. And that's a very, very large employer, very large creator of jobs around the country. And the idea is that maybe there's a bit of room for the Chinese to stimulate and boost their economy going into 2022.
So if I was to read between the lines and summarize just a little bit and condense what you've just told me, you're pretty chilled going into 2022 from a stock market perspective.
Yes. We don't think that things are going to fall in a heap growth-wise. We think that there's certainly room for returns, not at the scale at which we saw last year. Certainly that's going to slow down. But where the earnings growth comes through, I think you're going to be fine. But you are going to have to keep a watch on how especially the U.S. manages this inflationary spike and how that develops, because that's going to determine what we see happening to global interest rates. And global interest rates are a very, very important component of what determines what happens in the stock market.
Thank you very much to Arthur Karras, Portfolio Manager at the Old Mutual Investment Group.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa CIB. The bravery to imagine and the will to get things done. Now that's Africanacity. Absa's a registered FSP.
Welcome to The Money Show this evening. We'll chat to Peter Attard-Montalto in a moment. He is the head of capital markets at Intellidex as the UK looks to change its stance on travel bans, and it can't come a moment too soon. Certainly as the UK reports its first death as a result of the Omicron variant of COVID-19, and we're seeing a surge in cases in the UK. See reports today suggesting 40% of all cases in London are Omicron and will become the dominant strain tomorrow, they're anticipating. So, yeah, big deal, in fact, in terms of the two-week ban so far on South Africans and visitors to South Africa moving to the UK, of course, on flights. And so that's a big one. We'll pick up on that in a second. Also with Lunkile Mondi, he is at Wits University, all about what is going on with this idea of making the payments of COVID relief grants permanent and actually creating this idea of a basic income grant. Coming up on the next Money Show, we're in a Christmas mood. So in our investment school, we're discussing several gifting investment ideas that you can use for loved ones or for yourself. And then, of course, some really good ideas. And Andy Rice, I give you heroes and zeros from the world of advertising, all the latest money and business news coming up next time on The Money Show.
702. Bruce is on The Money Show.
Well, Britain's under siege Conservative government, reliably understood to be on the verge of scrapping its stupid red list regulation from South Africa 2 weeks after its arbitrary installation following our scientists' identifying of Omicron. Get it right. Instead, that country's transport minister, Grant Shapps, is said to be keen on introducing testing of fully vaccinated people who want to enter the UK as a safety measure. It's been deeply unpopular, apparently a dreadful and expensive quarantine process at hotels, costing citizens and other travellers alike nearly 50,000 rand a person for what reports suggest is a fairly horrific 10-day stay. Peter Attard-Montalto is the head of capital markets research at Intellidex. And it's been deeply unpopular, Peter, mostly because people have been treated with such disrespect and disregard in the United Kingdom when they arrive. It's been shambolically organized, the quarantining of people. Even if it was a legitimate course of action to try and stop the spread of COVID-19, it's actually hitting the Conservatives quite hard. They're opening themselves up to a huge amount of criticism.
Good evening, Bruce. Well, the real problem is how you want to frame this, right? You said it was sort of unwarranted in political terms. It was a necessary step. This government required a lot of distraction, certainly, around the time that it was put in place. And that's why I have some problems with the sort of hyperbole coming out of a lot of South African scientists about racism, etc. This was all down to politics. This was all down to the necessity of the moment. And really now we are on, hopefully, a clean path, if all fingers crossed, for a decision to be made for some kind of lifting later in the week. But there are still a lot of disagreements within the UK government. The government still and Downing Street under a lot of pressure still, politically, for their own foibles. So this is far from a done deal, unlike some of the press reports that have been positioning this in the last couple of days. But all fingers crossed, hopefully, for Thursday.
Yeah, because certainly we're seeing Omicron move through the United Kingdom like wildfire. I mean, we got tens of thousands of cases. Of course, the UK, which has been, lots of people have been going maskless for quite some time, from Wimbledon to the UEFA Cup final. I sat with envy watching sport with people sitting cheek by jowl, germ by germ, and thoroughly enjoying the great outdoors and the best that the British summer has got to offer. But the consequence of that, of course, has been that people are now being reinforced. Affected, although not with the level of fatality of previous waves, of course.
Well, this has been the problem with the UK messaging. So you're encouraged to work from home and not to commute, yet you're also allowed to go into a nightclub if it's below a certain size without even a test. Equally, the address from the Prime Minister last night highlighted, I thought, an exaggeration of the case of rising hospitalizations in South Africa. That's partly why I'm cautious around the red list being lifted. South Africa is still being used as this sort of cautionary tale for a more fearsome sort of view on Omicron from the government. So it really is quite a lot of mixed messaging coming out. Of course, hospitalizations in Gauteng have doubled, but from an exceptionally low base, and are still certainly much, much better than in previous waves. But the government here in the UK is not really quite saying that. So, interestingly, I think the extra steps we might see in South Africa coming into Christmas are probably going to be very light and may well be less than compared to the UK. So, very interesting shift in how countries are treating Omicron.
It's still politically expedient to have a whipping boy. South Africa is that whipping boy. Boris Johnson is not shy to abuse a distraction if he can, because he's got big problems of his own, does he not, in terms of his hold on authority within that government?
Well, this has really been a debate that's broken out in the UK around the further steps the government's taking here. On the moral ability or the moral credibility actually to do that, given some of the moves of the parties, etc., that happened even a year ago that have now come to the surface. But also I think it's very embarrassing for the government here to have people stuck, parted from their families, whether it's in South Africa or in quarantine, holed up in very, normally nice hotels offering exceptionally bad service and bad food in the red list hotels. And so that's what hopefully will push us over the edge in the end. But, I think ultimately we still have to remember the damage here really is to South Africa's tourism economy. The loss, so PwC put the number at about $6.5 billion. We have a number a little bit lower. It's about $4.5 billion rand that has been lost, not just for these few 2 weeks, which haven't been overly long. But it's really the long tail that then goes of cancelable bookings through the first half of next year. That's really the damage that is going to be felt from the tourism sector in South Africa.
And particularly because the UK has shown itself to be as knee-jerk and as trigger-happy as it is with lockdowns, very few people are going to be willing to take the risk of travelling into South Africa at the risk of not being able to get back home again.
Well, that's the thing I'm mulling. I am booked to come back for a very long trip in February. Hopefully see you in the studio. These things weigh on one's mind, certainly. I think, if it was a fair process, if there was a high quality and high standard of quarantine hotels, it would be a completely different matter. But that's not the situation we're in. And this, again, is the long-lasting tale of people. And what's very interesting, actually, the seasonality of tourism in South Africa, sort of older age, the LAPs who come to South Africa go well through this African winter, etc., where we could well be seeing another wave 5 in South Africa if vaccinations aren't picking up. And this cycle will just repeat all over again.
Unfortunately, yes. Peter Atard-Montalto, Head of Capital Markets at IntelliDex. Thank you very much indeed.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Now, the finance minister's made it pretty clear that he is not keen on the idea of implementing a basic income grant. South Africa simply doesn't have the depth of finances to do that. Our tax base has shrunk as a result of a couple of things. Immigration is a factor, and we've also seen, of course, the economy shrink to a point where even some of South Africa's super rich or even people in jobs have had to take cuts in their income. And so tax rates are struggling a little bit, although corporate taxes and the sort of royalties from the minerals boom that South Africa has enjoyed certainly are helping tax collections. It's not a fix for the long term until you get proper economic growth coming through and start seeing some proper job creation as a result of growth in the economy rather than simply doling out cash. Lumkile Mondi is lecturer in the School of Economics and Finance at Wits, and there's been this government-appointed panel, Lumkile, which has come out with its recommendations today. And I think you've got to be pretty cold-hearted with ice in your veins to not support the merits of a basic income grant in a country where so many people have got so few options in terms of employment. But at the same time, you've got to have your head screwed on tight when you look at the affordability of something like this. What is your take on today's recommendations?
It was expected, it was expected, Bruce, that the panel will recommend, given the high levels of unemployment and the fact that in South Africa, the situation is going to deepen, particularly following the discussion we just had with Peter in relation to our tourism and hospitality industry, which has really been now completely being battered by the recent travel bans. So really, we expected that committee to come up with that. The question, Bruce, that South Africans are always going to ask is, can such a program be sustainable in a shrinking economy with massive infrastructure problems and a lack of decisive leadership, parallel relating to the energy mix, where we know that at COP26, we got a very big deal. However, the Minister of Energy and of Minerals and Energy is dilly-dallying, caught up in fossil fuels. So these questions are serious to South Africa, given that you cannot implement an unsustainable program when you know that in 3 years' time you might have to reverse because the economy has shrunk so much.
Now, certainly we can't afford to pay for it, but can we afford to not have it, considering the huge social injustice that comes with an economy that is not geared for growth?
If you do implement it, Bruce, it has to be coupled with an economic program that allows private sector to create the wealth so that we know that through our tax systems that will continuously receive the tax receipts that could sustain in funding such a program. So for social justice, there is no debate in South Africa about the need for such a program. The question is the economy is shrinking. The policies are there, but there is a war of position about what to do about them. The government speaks in tongues. So therefore, up until we see action in the energy, for example, that we've been debating for the past 10 years, and nothing has happened. So when you've got packages such as the one we got at COP26, and you've got the minister going the other way, you wonder, if you do implement that program and you've got debates that are continuous around policy implementation, where private sector needs electricity, needs certainty, and therefore it wants that certainty to make money at the same time to do good for South Africa. When there's uncertainty on that, these programs then become quite difficult to implement when in 3 years' time we might have to reverse them because simply there is no money because the economy is much smaller because the decisions that are hard that needed to be taken were never taken by the political leadership.
There we go. Lumkile Mondi, thank you very much indeed. Lumkile is a senior lecturer at the School of Economics and Business Science at FITS.
702.
Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
I'm a little afraid this evening. I know I shouldn't be a little afraid. It's only Toby Shapshak and he's lovely. He is the chief at Stuff Studios. But you're giving us a cooking lesson tonight, not a tech lesson. Or is the cooking as a result of the tech, Toby Shapshak?
I think it's a little bit of both, Bruce, but I like to know that I can still make you feel afraid, even if
desperately afraid.
Even if it's pretend afraid, as my four-year-old would say. Well, I tell you what this is, Bruce, and I did this last Christmas, and while I was thinking of Christmas-related themes for this December month, obviously, as Jews often do, I was just thinking about how I made turkey last year, and I used this fantastic new cooking technique called sous vide. If you're wondering what that means, it just means boil in a bag in French. Because
it's not what it means. It's what it is.
It's what it is. But basically, it's a very sophisticated boil in the bag, and it is like the cooking style du jour, and for good reason. And I came across a really great South African company that makes this technology, sous vide, sousvide.co.za. And they make a really brilliant setup, and this is what I use. So this is the essential idea, Bruce. So you take whatever you're cooking. In my case, it was a turkey, which I had spatchcocked. You put tinfoil over the very sharp bone so it doesn't prick the vacuum seal plastic bag that you put it in. You seal it, and then you put it in water, in a tub of water, and you cook it for, in this case, 5 hours because of the size of the turkey. Sorry, 6 hours at 65.5 degrees Celsius. And because, you know, when you're a journalist, you don't have to be an expert, as you well know, Bruce. You just have to have the phone number of an expert. I phoned one of the great South African chefs, Arnold Tanzer. I asked him what to do. He told me what to do, and I cooked it for 6 hours at 55.5 degrees Celsius, and the turkey came out spectacular. I turned on the braai. I just browned it a little bit on the braai, and then it was a really great turkey. So this is the essential thing about cooking, which sous vide has made possible, and that is most cooking cooks the outside of the meat or the vegetable or the potato or the whatever, and you cook it for a longer time at a lower heat, say in an oven or in a braai, so that the heat can penetrate inside. Sous vide turns it on its head and it cooks something at, you know, 65.5 degrees or 65 degrees is relatively cool in terms of cooking heat. But say, for instance, I'm an unrepentant carnivore and I like rump or ribeye medium rare. You cook it at a certain temperature, I forget, I think it's 58 or 59 degrees for 3 hours, and then you take it out and you sear it on the braai, and it comes out beautifully. And what sous vide does is just cook at a consistent temperature for a certain amount of hours, and it replicates what you would get if you cooked something, if you baked something for a really long time.
Jamie,
I know
your name?
I sound like a bit of a crazy person. But,
Heston, you know, that's your name. Cook Jamie turkey, Gordon Heston. Heston. No, but okay. Tell Heston me about the Shapshak. Tech, Toby. Heston Shapshak. Tell me about the tech.
So this is the best part. It's a cylindrical vertical thing that you put in the water, and it's called, I love it, a thermal immersion circulator. It sounds like something from a sci-fi movie, doesn't it? But you put it in this vat of water, it keeps it at a consistent temperature, and it keeps circulating. And then you can cook vegetables, and you can cook a whole bunch of things in there. And you can just see the chefs are just besotted for this thing because it cooks things so perfectly. You can get it for 2,700 Rand. It comes with a whole bunch of other odds and ends. And it is just fantastic. The company
and
is sousvide.co.za. And the chef who did it all, and I love the story, Bruce, and it's just such a great a Boermaker plan. The guy's name is Jan Vollmer, and he's the managing director of another company that makes kitchen products. And he started experimenting with sous vide technology. He couldn't find it. So he had the stuff made, and he sells it at very reasonable prices, 2,700 Rand, I can tell you.
For the chef outfit
is fantastic. You get these giant bars. It's just, I mean, I must say, I like to cook. Considering that my mother, who's listening, hi, Ma, is the only Jewish mother who couldn't cook and wouldn't cook, I really love cooking. And this is just a fantastic way. And turkey, as you know, the Jew who's only cooked three turkeys in his life, it can come out very dry. I used to use Nadella Lawson's recipe, which required you to brine the turkey for 2 days and then baste it with duck fat and maple syrup every 15 minutes. That came out juicy.
Okay. So listen, Heston,
Gordon, I just like to find it.
Toby, we must
Heston
leave it there. Thank you so much for the cooking lessons. I'm really grateful for those. But sous vide, it's a lovely idea because, yeah, so, I mean, life's too short for Heston and certainly for Nigella's brining over 2 days of a bloomin' turkey. Life is too short for that stuff. We're far too busy. But sous vide, I think we could live with sous vide. And there's some local tech to allow you to do French cooking at home with very little trouble. Even Toby Shapshak can do it. Chief at Stuff Studios.
You're with Bruce Whitfield
on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
The Money Show is brought to you by Absa CIB, playing a meaningful role in the societies they serve. The bravery to imagine, that's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. Welcome to The Money Show. JP Luntman standing by. We'll chat to him in just a moment about the possibility of life beyond load shedding, as Eskom announces in the last couple of minutes, to switch off everything that you have near and dear to you in order to conserve power because the grid is vulnerable. Not yet announcing load shedding, but they do often. Would you drink Oreo wine? You know the biscuits made by, they've got a Nabisco label on them, but I think like most things, Mondelez is the ultimate owner of Oreos. Well, popular American wine label Barefoot Wines has signed up with Oreo to market a co-branded wine, which claims, and I read from a release, the red blend includes flavors of chocolate and cookies and cream, along with notes of oak, adding that the wine is also crafted to be enjoyed together as a perfect pairing with Oreos, in case you're wondering. Oreo has called itself the milk cookie's favorite, or the milk's favorite cookie, I think that's what they call themselves, and that wants to be wine's favorite cookie. It sounds grotesque, and they're selling it at 25 Rand a bottle, which in real money today is about 375 Rand a bottle. For that, you can get an incredibly good local wine and several packets of Oreos for that price. So I wouldn't waste my time drinking Barefoot Wine's version of something that you could do at home for much, much less money.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Bite the biscuit. Take a sip. JP Luntman, political and trends analyst, is on the line to us from Johannesburg. And you're imagining a future beyond Eskom's chaos. And I think we'll talk about that in just a moment. But before we do, JP, I think the year has panned out considerably better than most people had anticipated and considerably better than most people could have hoped for, certainly from an economic and a fiscal perspective. In February, we were in big, big trouble. Now we're just in big trouble. Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. It was big, and now it's only big progress of sorts.
Yeah, it's. And look, you don't take giant leaps, I suppose. But I think, you know, and your analysis at the beginning of the year was, yes, we're in trouble, but actually there are lots of things that are going right, and many of those things have come right.
Yes, they have. And I think all in all, the year has ended quite well. If you think that we had an unpleasant surprise in July with the unrest, and in spite of that, we're going to have, for the first time in 6 years, we're going to have a year in which economic growth trumps population growth quite handsomely. Now, that's, of course, one swallow doesn't make a summer, and, of course, it comes from a low base. We all know that. But the fact is we've broken a six-year trend. But I think there's a good chance that in 22, 23, we will keep on this new trajectory. So, yeah, all in all, I think the year ended better than what we thought.
The biggest of many problems that we have, and the core to many of the problems that we have, is a lack of faith in energy security. I mean, Eskom is buckling under the weight of aging fleet rather than off demand. I think yesterday there was only 25,000 megawatts required in the economy, and today not much more than that. It's a drop in the ocean, really. But Eskom's fleet is in trouble, and it's one of the biggest messes we've got to get through is electricity. And very few people are willing to look through the crisis to a possible resolution. You've done that. Tell me, high level, what you see potentially is happening.
Well, what I see potentially happening is that load shedding will be with us until the end of 2022. So we must be aware of that and prepared to live for another year with load shedding. But then I think we're going to see quite a dramatic change in the landscape simply because so much new investment is pouring in and so much new money is going into new capacity. We will plug the capacity gap over the next 2 to 3 years. There's no question about it. And it's much more than that, Bruce. You've mentioned the fact that the Eskom fleet is very old. Now, the average age of the fleet, if you ignore Kusile and Medupi, is 41 years. It's coming to the end of its life. A lot of Eskom power stations will be decommissioned in the next 10 years and even more in the 10 years after that. Now, as you decommission, you have to replace. You have to build new capacity. And the plans for that are quite well advanced. And the new capacity will come in. It will be largely renewables, not 100%, but largely. It will be all, I think I want to underline that, it will be all private sector investment. Whether it's wind or solar or even gas, it will all be private sector investment. And we're looking at quite an investment bonanza for the country. So yes, short term, load shedding, no question. Medium term, a lot of investment in capacity. Longer term, even more investment in capacity. And I think if we take a 5 to 10 year view, it's quite clear to me that energy, in its broader sense, will become the new discovery of gold in South Africa. And South Africa is basically what it is because we industrialized on the back of the gold discoveries of the 19th century. And I think we're looking at that again. My numbers show, or my back of the cigarette box numbers indicate that in the next 10 years and more, we're going to invest more than R1 trillion in generating capacity, in distribution or transmission upgrades rather, but also in distribution upgrades. You add all those numbers together and you make provision for the switch that Eskom will do from coal-fired power stations to other sources of energy, and you're looking at huge, huge amounts of investment. And on the back of that, you can do a lot of localization and industrialization. So, yeah, I think it's an exciting future if you can see beyond load shedding, which I think we must try and do, and if you can see beyond car powership. I don't know whether car powership will take place or not. I don't know. But I've assumed in my research speech that it doesn't go ahead. So don't expect any megawatts from there. Don't expect any investment from there. And if you ignore that and you just work with the rest, the picture is one of a lot of capacity going to be installed.
And I took some in Eyewitness News earlier today. The reports were that the president has been handed the report cards for his government ministers. And I wonder, being the strategist that Cyril Ramaphosa has shown himself to be over time, not wanting to make the unpopular decisions himself, and wanting to be seen to be building a government of consensus and a country of consensus, whether he's been waiting for these report cards so that he can start finally restructuring his cabinet, which is a bit like Eskom, full of a bit of an aging fleet. And I wonder if this is an opportunity.
It may be an opportunity. I mean, I don't know what he plans in that score. But I would just point out that so far, Mr. Mantashe is taking a bad press, and part of it is his own fault. But, you know, I must just point out he's doing everything which was set out in the IRP of 2019, the Integrated Resource Plan of October 2019. It's now 2 years later, 26 months later, and basically everything that's been in there, everything that was envisaged in that IRP, he has been implementing. It has been going slower than the needs of the country, but that, I think, speaks, Bruce, to the fact that we've got a regulatory setup and we've got a legislative setup that needs to change. I don't think it's just Mr. Montashe trying to go slow. There are problems in the way that we have structured our industry and the way we run our electricity industry, but that's a completely different topic. What we should do, as opposed to what we are doing, they are two very different topics. And what we should do around our industry and how we regulate it and how we manage it is as I say, a different topic. I think Mr. Montashe has done, he's delivered what is in the IRP 2019. He is trying to defend the use of coal. I don't know whether that will work. I don't think so. But you can't blame a man for trying to do that. Medupi and Kusile will be with us for at least another 40 years. They're not even fully operational yet. And in those 40 years, they're going to use a huge amount of coal. So we're not going to see a dead stop on coal just overnight. It's not going to happen. We will see a decisive tilt to renewables, no question about that. But it doesn't mean that we go to zero coal overnight. And I think Mr. Montashe is trying to appreciate that point. I think politically he plays a very important role, and I think he's helped the president to bring the ANC and the alliance partners to the point where we are, i.e. that they accept the role of renewables, they accept that it must be part of our future, and we must accept the consequences of that. That was not the case 3 years ago when Ramaphosa took over. It was most decidedly not the case. There was huge opposition to the splitting up of Eskom, huge opposition to signing renewables, huge opposition to moving away from coal. All those political obstacles have been cleared substantially. And I think Mr. Montashe did play his role in that. So, you know, it's always better to have the devil that you know than the one that you don't know.
Absolutely. The trends, by the tone and the way in which you are positioning our discussion this evening, the trends are still going in the right direction, it would seem.
Oh, absolutely. We're going to go to renewables, no question about that. It's going to be private sector led, no question about that. It's going to break the Eskom monopoly, no question about that. We're going to see more competition, hopefully much better prices than what we have at the moment. And over time, we should be able to drive that down, the prices down, which will, of course, help our industrial development. And this is a huge opportunity. The whole energy thing is a huge opportunity to drive industrialization. As I've said, Bruce, South Africa basically industrialized between 1924 and 1984. In those 60 years, roughly, we became an industrial economy, and then things fizzled out. The use of energy enables us now to get back on that trajectory, and that's before we talk things like hydrogen, which very much is future music and is dependent on technological breakthroughs. But the fact is, we're working on the breakthroughs. I think that's what is important. We're putting effort into developing and pushing that technology. So yes, I think if you look at electricity, you look at hydrogen, you look at the move away from coal, I think there's a huge, huge frontier for investment and development in South Africa in electricity. And all of that is beyond load shedding. So tonight we have load shedding, yes. We will have it for another year, yes. Mm. But, you know, the future doesn't end in a year's time. There is a future beyond that.
Thank you, JP Landman, as always, the political and economics analyst, the trends analyst, JP Landman this evening. And yeah, it is that ability to look through the short term, that ability to look through the noise. And it's one of the titles, noise, by the way, is one of the titles of a book that Hilton Kellner is going to talk to us about. Hilton is the chief executive at Discovery Bank, and he has got a list of books. And I'm not too sure why he compiles this list. I think it is to give his colleagues a little bit of homework over the holidays. We'll talk to him about it in a moment.
The Money Show.
Business books.
To Hilton Kellner, the chief executive of Discovery Bank. You've got a fairly young family. You are growing a bank, and you still find time, Hilton, to read business books. How do you fit it in?
Hi, Bruce. I don't fit a lot of it in during the year, but during holidays, I try to catch up a bit.
The Sanlam chief executive, Paul Hanratty, said to me the other day, he thinks that most business books are a waste of time. I think he's probably right, actually. But you've got to be very selective in what you consume.
Yeah, I think that you might be right. I think that you can probably take a lot out of most books. But I tend to focus on biographies. I found them fascinating. So it's far less about business, more about people. And I tend to try and learn as well when I read. So a lot of books on behavioral economics, and really the area that we focus on. So it's less about, I think, strategy and management or leadership, much more around stories about personal stories. And I suppose the areas that we tend to focus on at Discovery, which are also my personal passion.
So how do you choose the books? I mean, do you go through Amazon reviews? Do you have some sort of algorithm that helps you choose? How do you make that choice?
I wish. No, I think it's a bit of a combination. Over the course of the year, I'll often make notes as I go along and pick up books that I think look interesting. And I've got a pile in my study at home where I sort of accumulate them. And then towards the end of the year, I'll go through and find the ones that I'm keen on reading. And then for each person in the team, as you say, you know, it has become a bit of a joke that this is Hilton's homework for the holiday. I'll select a couple of books that I think are sort of most relevant for each person or that they could really enjoy. And I give them as a thank you to the members of my team. And I think, you know, they appreciate it.
And do they have to write a test when they come back in January?
No test. There's no test at all. This is purely for enjoyment and to feed the soul a little bit over the holiday break, and hopefully to actually take their mind off work.
And it's a wonderfully diverse list. I want to focus in on one or two of them, but just broadly speaking, there are a couple of sports biographies. The Master, the Brilliant Career of Roger Federer, and you've got Rise, the story of Sia Khulisi in there. Sports biographies are weirdly appropriate in the world of business, aren't they?
Yeah, they really are. You know, I think there's that sort of competitive edge that winning in business requires that you find, you know, great sports people have sort of really that ingrained in their DNA. But I think they're different. I think that CEO's story is just incredible, coming from such humble beginnings and really epitomizes. It's just an amazing, amazing South African story. And I think it's inspirational and I think we should almost all read it. And Federer, I've just loved over the years. To me, he sort of epitomizes the grand master and an absolutely brilliant sportsman, but just a really amazing human being. So I think, you know, those two are, I think, really great books. And as you say, nothing to do with business, but a huge amount that we can learn from them.
And how does a recipe book get into this particular list?
So I'm a... that does stand out. So I'm a huge fan of Otto Lenghi and his sort of Middle Eastern cooking. I saw the book. My wife loved it, and I thought it's just an amazing gift. We've got our healthy food studio at Discovery. We really do promote healthy eating. And I thought as a change. It's the first time I've ever given a cookbook as one of the gifts that I've given. But I know that a lot of the members of my team have a passion for cooking, so when I saw it, I thought, you know, that's perfect for a few people, and I'd loved it.
And then you've got a you've got Reid Hoffman's book, Masters of Scale, which is something that Discovery obsesses about a lot. You've got Rationality, which is another, it's behavioral economics, of course, which is something that, that Discovery focuses on a lot. And then I suppose Dominance in Amazon, Brad Stone's book on Amazon Unbound. And Jeff Bezos, who, you know, isn't the world's warmest individual, but certainly has built one of the most extraordinary businesses on the planet, and there must be lots of lessons in there that you'd like your team to take out.
Yeah, I think that so it's one that I haven't read yet, but I plan to read first. And exactly, I think, you know, that the Amazon story is incredible, and I'm anticipating that there's a huge amount to learn in that one.
And then one that that appeals to me hugely, because, and it was essentially what I was talking to JP Luntman just a moment ago, that ability to see through noise, that ability to really block out the stuff that is not useful and not relevant. And Daniel Kahneman, who's a Nobel Prize winning author, he wrote Thinking Fast and Slow. He talks about decision making and noise and the ability to cut through the nonsense and focus on what's really important. And I go back to the origin story of Discovery in 1992 in South Africa on the brink of civil war, and a young actuary from Liberty goes to see Laurie Dipinard. His name is Adrian Gore, and says, I've got an idea. And in the midst of probably one of the most destructive potential times in South Africa's history, sows the seeds of Discovery because of an ability to do precisely that, to cut out the noise of the present and look to the future.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's the ability to, as you say, sort of see through the noise and make decisions based on the sort of clarity of facts and vision. It's what Discovery's been built on, exactly as you say. And I think with big data emerging and having more and more data at our fingertips, the ability to ask the right questions and to remove the noise from the analysis that we see is crucial. And, you know, in our environment, big data, data analytics, and data science is so core to everything that we do that it's something that I think will appeal to a lot of our people. And as you say, Daniel Kahneman is the father of behavioral economics, and so, you know, that's where we turn for sort of real intellect in the space.
And Indra Nooryi was a guest on the show, what, 3 weeks ago, 2 weeks ago? You know, recently, Indra Nooryi, the former chief executive and chair of PepsiCo. This is an interesting one in your list because it's not a particularly aggressive biography, but certainly Indra Nooryi comes out of, not many chief executives leave a job on a high. Often people stay too long or they do something that they get caught short on. But she's quite a rare individual in that she actually emerges from a chief executive job in far better shape than when she went in. And that's, I suppose, is the standout factoid of that one. It is possible to go in, do a decent and honourable job, and to grow your reputation rather than so many people who don't.
Yeah, and she transformed the business. You know, she transformed it from sort of a sugar-based soft drink business to sort of embrace health and wellness. And just did an incredible job. So I think, and you know, just in terms of her humanity, I think there's something that we can really, really learn from her. So beyond the sort of, as you say, the management and the leadership lessons, she's I think just incredibly inspirational in her humanity, and I think that's something that sort of shines through in the book, and hopefully we'll come through to the people that read it.
How many of these books will you be able to read over the holidays, have a holiday, connect with your family and get a decent break and come back with a bounce in your step next year? Will you read 5, 6, 7? Do you read fast?
Yeah, I do. So hopefully I'll get through 5 or 6 of them. I only have probably 5 or 6 of them to read. So I've read a couple of them through the course of the year, and I've got about 5 or 6 of them that I'm going to try and get through over the course of the next 3 or so weeks.
Happy reading. Hilton Kellner, thank you for sharing your list with us. Chief Executive at Discovery Bank. Every year, he compiles a list of books that he, through the year, he's got no time to read the things, so he puts them all together. My producers will tweet a link, won't you? Won't you? Yes, you will. Thank you very much. You see, they're nodding. Nodding. Nodding producers are good producers. They will tweet a list of those books for you because they are in that collection. I can't see one that I would not want to read. There's another one that we didn't get to, or two that we didn't. The Powerful and the Damned, which is Lionel Barber's book, which I haven't yet got to, a former editor-in-chief of the Financial Times. I had the privilege of working a little bit with him 10 years ago or so, 12 years, a long time ago, and a remarkable mind as a leader in a newsroom and transformed the Financial Times into the digital powerhouse that it is. The other one is Choose Possibility. This is another one, and it's by Sukhinder Singh Cassidy, and she's a female tech executive in Silicon Valley, and she talks about choosing possibility, poor choices, pitfalls, and really this idea, again, optimistic outlook on the world. A very optimistic look on books this evening from the chief executive at Discovery Bank, Hilton Kellner.
See beyond the screen. The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa CIB. The bravery to imagine and the will to get things done. Now that's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
The Money Show.
Other people's money.
On a Monday night, we invite somebody who is a household name to come and talk to us about money and what they think about money, how they treat money. Tonight, I'm going to introduce you to somebody who you will know very well from your super sports screen, but there is something about them I almost am willing to bet, if I was a betting kind of guy, you did not know about them. Onan Nkumane panel-beated opposition rugby players for years, and in 2017 opened up his own panel-beater shop. You didn't know that about Onan Nkumane, did you? Owen, welcome to The Money Show. Good to have you with us this evening. It's been a long time since you played a rugby game, I don't want to say in anger, but with intent. You've settled into super sport very, very comfortably, haven't you?
Yeah, very good evening, Bruce. Firstly, thanks for the invite. Very surprised that you invited me.
Why?
Yeah, I'm a normal guy, Bruce. You know, I'm the guy. I'm just like a local.
You're
the
guy. Gotcha.
I'm just that guy, you know. Yeah, so yeah, 2017, me and my brother started a auto body shop, you know, looking to get involved in the motor space. And the idea was, you know, it needs to turn. So it's a long-term thing. We're looking 10, 20 plus years, and that's where we're trying to position ourselves. It hasn't been easy, but it's been good. Some tough learnings, and we'll get there. We'll get there.
Thank goodness South Africa's are terrible drivers. So, I mean, you've got an income stream in perpetuity. Is your brother the panel beater? Does he know about the auto body work? It's not something that you've ever studied. It's not something that you've ever done, is it?
Not at all. I mean, the industry's changed so much. A lot of tradesmen back in the past started their own shops, but now it's as good as any business. You know, I always ask the question, Alex Ferguson, you know, how many goals you score for Man United? And people turn around and I get the exact same silence.
That? What?
And then I say, always surround yourself with people who know more than you. The biggest thing is just managing those and putting them in the limelight. And that's how you build businesses. That's how it's a teamwork. Nobody is an expert on their own. Always surround yourself with those that know more than you. You're fortunate enough to be a leader in a space. And you just manage those people, and they'll make you look good.
I'd have a big room with lots of people in it. There'd be no social distancing because there'd be too many people. Take me back, please, in history. Where were you born? Where did you grow up?
Bruce, born and bred in Soweto. That's where I'm from. You know, from day one. I understand concrete, the streets. Yeah, that's what I understand.
How did you crack the nod to get to St. John's College, one of the most elite schools in South Africa? You went to the prep, you played cricket in prep and football in prep, and then the rugby bug bit when you got to the college as an under 14. But take me through that story, if you would.
Yeah, so it was during the uprising in Soweto when the schooling system was all interrupted. And there was a lot of movement of trying to get kids to the private schools. I mean, you take it back. I think Sacred Heart was the first one to allow non-white students. We're talking maybe 79, 80. St. John's was also there. I think the first African guy was also like 79, 78. And it's from that, you know, my dad made a conscious effort. And I went, I mean, I wrote tests at St. David's and Martin's, some of the CBC schools. And St. John's was the last one. And some of them, some of those schools I never got in. And St. John's was the last one. Me and my brother got into the school. And that's how it came about. I think at the time, the year before that, 86, my sister went to St. Barnabas. There was a movement there. A lot of black kids sending their kids there in Bosmont. And that's how I ended up at St. John's. But, you know, my first interaction with St. John's came 1980, 1981. You know, I must have been a 5-6-year-old boy as an altar boy. And so I went to a church in Rockville. And once a year, around December, around this time, when all the servers basically got a little Christmas party, we'd actually go to St. John's and play soccer, have a little picnic. And that was my first interaction with the school, was through the church, the Anglican church. And that's how we, you know, fell in love with the buildings, I suppose. And got very fortunate to be accepted at the school. My dad's also got another story and how he how he got me to the school. Funny enough, so when my daughter, trying to get my daughter to a school, my dad told me, he said, listen, this is how I did it. You're even in a better space than I am. Basically, just get off the butt and then drive to the school and just ask them. And then, so that's how he got into St. John's. He didn't fill any forms. He drove there and they said to him, have you got a meeting with the headmaster? He says, no, I want my kids to come to the school. And they said, he says, no, but I'll wait. And he waited. And then from then on, you know, we got the, we got the date to come write the entry test.
It's amazing, isn't it? I mean, I remember as a 5-year-old sitting on those stands watching my brothers play rugby on that field, on the first team field, and just turning around and looking at these majestic sandstone buildings, which were so, they were four times bigger in those days because you're that much smaller. But you had an extraordinarily successful career, as one would expect at St. John's, and you were in the first 15 for 2 years, 93, 94 as captain. And I mean, you've got the record of whipping Paul Boys High, which is very rare for any captain of any school in the world, never mind in South Africa. They're a tough rugby school. You also were a capable cricket player, and you matriculated in 94, you captain St. John's College rugby team. You then get selected to join the Springboks, and everybody knows that story. But you've also now been honoured, and this must be absolutely enormous. I mean, by your old school, they've now got, you know, a memorial to you in your lifetime, as a permanent sort of fixture at St. John's College, and they treat you as a pioneer. Which I think you are. Do you see yourself as a pioneer?
It's a heavy title to accept, Bruce. So for me, as be true to yourself, do the right thing, the rest will follow. I mean, this is one of the things that we all picked up as kids. And how I got into that mindset as well was, you know, growing up as a teen, you'd get into trouble, and my dad would get a phone call from the school. And he sat me down once and he says, whatever you do from now on, you take full responsibility. Good or bad, there'll be repercussions. So you must decide which way you want to go. And I'm as I said, I went on every day trying to do the best as I could. And that was a result of it, you know, being honored by the St. John's community. But it's bigger than that. You know, I think that just makes a statement for any kid, regardless where they come from. When they hear the story, want to find out what is this terrace all about, then they'll realize that anything is possible. And I say this again because, you know, a lot of people walk into that space as broken souls. And I use that very loosely. Nobody walks into that building as an expert in something. And that's what St. John's was back in the day, and I still hope it is. I know they're very academic at the time. But it was open arms to regardless where you came from. And you walk out there fully trained, body, mind, and character, and that's key. You know, I think, you know, as much as the world has changed and we're all about whatever, the goalposts in any organization keeps changing, And I think this year's head boys, I mean, head boy, I heard his speech. I thought Sazi's speech spot on. You know, he talks about his journey walking to the school and hearing his speech now as a young man, you can tell it's a totally different kid. He can go in any space where he wants to go. And that's the beauty of being privileged and being honored and being lucky enough to have come through that school.
Did you appreciate the magnitude of the experience of not only a private school, but of going to a St. John's College at the time when you were in it? So often when you're in it, it's normal. And it's just going to school. And, you know, some teachers are a pain, some kids are a pain. It's the regular experience. Did you appreciate the huge opportunity that was being afforded to you at the time?
Yeah, absolutely. As I said, I mean, my first interaction with the school was as a 5-6-year-old and being fortunate enough to get in that space. And the thing as well is, you know, they had wanted two guys who were older than me who came from the same community who were at the school. So there was people to look up to. And I was fortunate enough, you know, the sport, the cultural part. And by the way, I got kicked out of the choir twice. So tells you about my
with that voice. You must have been bad. Yeah, no.
That was very bad. So Bruce, yeah, I did appreciate it. And also, you know, back in the day, I'm talking early 90s, 80s, the community, when I say community, especially if coming from Soweto, there was so much expected of you because it was drilled into you that you are privileged, you are very fortunate, you don't waste the opportunity, you are never entitled. I mean, one of the funny stories is, I mean, I think most of us used taxis back in the day, and, you know, trying to compare that with my kids today is totally different. When I went to a sporting fixture as a prep school boy, you know, I was a boarder in the high school, I would never have to queue carrying my cricket bag at the taxi rank. So the taxi marshals recognize that this is what this kid is doing. And when he comes in a Saturday, he's not going to stand in the queue because he's got somewhere to go. So there was a big community involvement, regardless who you were, where you came from. And I mean, we took it for granted at the time. But, you know, they realized that, well, this kid needs to do something every time on a Saturday. He comes, you know, by 7 o'clock, he'll be here. And I'll never have to stand in a queue at all when I was carrying my cricket bat.
It's a wonderful story. Owen Nkumane, don't go away. I want to talk to you about money in a moment. Former rugby player, of course, presenter at Supersport, co-owner of a business with his brother in the auto body sector. So he's an entrepreneur as well as Owen Nkumane. We'll talk to him more about this in a moment.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa CIB. The bravery to imagine and the will to get things done. Now that's Africanacity. Absa's a registered FSP.
That was a surprise. Eyewitness News team has had a collective heart attack. Oh, my goodness me. Sorry about that news. Owen Nkumane is with us this evening. He is our guest on Other People's Money on this Monday evening. You grew up in a very privileged environment at St. John's College, Owen. I mean, you were surrounded by kids from all over the country, from all over Africa, I'm sure, by the time you matriculated. And there was a lot of money thrown about at the time. Did you feel like you fitted into that environment? Were you comfortable in that environment?
Yeah, as I said, Bruce, we're very comfortable. Yeah, you know, I had something to offer. I think I was part of the community. And there were guys who came from Soweto, so it wasn't really alien as such. But also, the guys never flaunted their money. I think it was frowned upon, even if today. And I mean, I know schools and spaces have changed. I mean, those that flaunt their money just don't fit in. You know, they'll get by, sure. They'll finish their 12 years, whatever, but they just don't fit in.
Mm. Were you well schooled in money? Did you get good lessons around the dinner table at home, talking about investments, talking about businesses? You and your brother have gone into business together now. Was there lots of talk about money at home?
No, not at all. I mean, we come from an era whereby, you know, kids must be seen, not heard. You could only ask one or two questions, not all of them. Not at all. No, but I think just the attitude towards it whereby, from my mom, keep everything under the radar. I think that was it, you know. Keep your stuff private. And just, they never showed that they did not never had enough. But as kids, they always made sure we got what we needed, not always what you wanted. But that's how we understood money. And also back in the day, everything was quite open. You know, you'd be given chores and then let's go do shopping. And you got to look after, you got to make sure the change is correct when you come back. Anybody could send you to the shop to go buy them whatever if they're older. So my first interaction with money was from the community itself and the family. But, you know, the father next door could just scream out my name and then say, listen, I need to go buy bread and milk. And yeah, there was Bob Klaba next door. I mean, he was an old man. And he would send us to the shops and we've got to make sure his change is correct. So first interaction of money was that.
A really important life lesson there as well about integrity and treating other people's money as theirs and understanding the value of personal property and the integrity of not only doing the job, but ensuring that the change came back. And it seems tiny, I suppose, in retrospect, but it's one of those fundamental building blocks of trust and partnerships into the future.
Absolutely. And the guys who never brought back the change, they got a proper whipping. So you didn't want to be part of that setup. And then you'd be labeled a tortie and all sorts. And
No, but that's the thing. That's the most powerful thing. I mean, the whipping is not great. Nobody wants to be whipped. But the reputational issues that come with being asked to look after somebody else's money is substantial.
Yeah, spot on. And also, I mean, my parents were blue collar. So, I mean, if there was something in the community, people would come ask for help and you know, at times money. I mean, back in the 80s, and I'll say this the way it was said, you know, and the older generation will understand, ipasela. So ipasela would mean anything. It would mean you would receive, you'd take it. So that would be cash. It could be food. It could be anything. So the older people never tell you what's in the package. You just got to make sure it gets there. And now and again, you go pick up. Now and again, you have to go take it. And that's how, and the stock fell was quite big as well. You learned how money worked based on the stock fells. And I mean, growing up, there was my mom and her sisters had a stock field and they called it Imali Abafazi and it came out every Jan. And that money used to make sure everybody's got school uniform, the books and everything. That's all it was there for. So the relationship with money that you've got to save to spend, you've got to have a bit. And there's some things that are more important than other things. So, I mean, it's like growing up, we never bought Christmas clothes. We never understood it because it was just a day. So you'd wear whatever slops you had, your T-shirt, whatever, not because you couldn't afford it. My mom would say, but, you know, I buy you clothes throughout the whole year. You know, you've got your summer clothes, your winter clothes. Christmas is just a normal day. Yes, this family, have lunch, do whatever.
But you say you didn't get grow up with money lessons and stuff, but it strikes me that mum and the stork fell were instrumental in teaching value of money.
No, extremely, extremely. I mean, so when I got my first job, as a 16-year-old during this time, actually, during Christmas holidays. And Bruce, the reason I got the job is because I went looking for it wearing a St. John's uniform. There was four or five of us, and we got to this department store, and the head of HR was a St. John's guy. And basically, we didn't have to do anything after that. And I kept the job all the way to varsity. And even then, so my first paycheck I had to take home, and they said, oh, well, you know, they took a bit out. They gave me the most of it, said you could do whatever. And as a 16-year-old, I'm sure I made sure that I could go to the movies, odds and ends like that, buy lots of sweets and things like that. Nothing really, you know, tangible as such, but they took a good percentage, you know, of that money.
And hey, that's the way the world works. Onukumani, thank you for sharing with us this evening. And thank you for telling us the stories. And I think Mum was instrumental, really instrumental. And the Stokvel was instrumental as well. Stokvels, I think, must be a great learning ground for understanding collaborative efforts with money, understanding trust and who you do trust and who you don't trust and how to save and put money away for things that are so flippant necessary. Thank you, Onukumani, this evening for sharing your stories about money.